The Volume.
This is Prime Cuts, the best of the Colin Cowherd podcast. And for God's sakes, do you know how good you have to be the best of my podcast? What a standard. This is a big week. Legendary former NFL GM Bill Polian gives us the most important thing he looks for in a player. Cowboys writer Matt Mosley was awesome. He tells you what he didn't like about the Cowboys draft, and there was a lot. Colts GM Chris Ballard comes on and talks why he believes Carson Wentz will return to that MVP level. And UCLA head coach Chip Kelly, unique perspective on the game, NFL and college. But first, my top takes of the week. So Terry Bradshaw got some Twitter heat because he came on my show, The Herd, and he said, I wouldn't coddle Aaron Rodgers. I wouldn't baby him. I just force him to play. Which, by the way, Green Bay can do. And it may be the best remedy for at least 1 year because the salary cap dead money hit would be so punitive if they moved him. The reality here is Aaron Rodgers doesn't have a no-trade clause. They can send him largely wherever they want. To me, the place that makes a lot of sense isn't Denver. It's New York. The Giants have 2 first-round picks next year, 2 third-round picks, and 2 fourth-round picks. So Green Bay could get a first, a third, and a fourth just next year, and it wouldn't damage the Giants' rebuild, and it would absolutely help the Packers' rebuild. I'm more of a rip-the-Band-Aid-off guy. To me, I'd rather just move on fast, but it doesn't necessarily make great sense for the Packers, and it doesn't make great sense for the Giants. I think you could make this move at the trading deadline in October next year. You don't have to make it now, and you don't have to make it before the season, nor do you have to wait until after the season. Let's see if Daniel Jones can play. If he starts off 6-1, eliminates the turnovers, he's young, he's cheap, he's athletic, and he's winning. So Green Bay moves off Aaron, would have their own first and 2 other firsts. The Packers historically pretty good at drafting and developing. That also gives Jordan Love another 6, 7, 8 weeks, OTA, exhibition season, camp, 7, 8 weeks behind Aaron Rodgers. If Jordan Love's not quite ready, give him 6 or 7 weeks watching Aaron play for the Packers. I don't give grades on the draft. And my feeling on this has always been, I don't consider the draft in itself gradable. I'm wrong enough. I think when something can be proven wrong over and over and over and over again, then I stop believing in it. If my Blazing Five was wrong under 50% every year, I'd stop doing it. But like 14 of the last 15 years, it's been over 500, about 53 to 56%. So I keep doing it. The grading system is mostly nonsense. What I do, and I'll do this on Fox Sports 1 and Fox Sports Radio, is that I'll take your top 3 free agent moves and combine it with your top 2 or 3 picks. And that gives you a much better hit rate on who really had a great draft. But trying to guess your 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th round picks, nobody knows. I mean, take New England. You know, I think Mac Jones, it's going to take a couple of games against Josh Allen, and you're going to realize you don't have a 2021 athlete at quarterback. So if he doesn't work, how good of a draft is it? Same with Chicago, Justin Fields. If he doesn't hit, I think he will with Matt Nagy, but if he doesn't, how can you give that draft an A+? Everybody's like, Bears, A+. You don't know. You won't know for 2 years. Kansas City's not getting viewed as a great draft, but they literally rebuilt their offensive line with 2 elite players on the left side. Well, for Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes, that will have a significantly greater impact than probably any drafted player over the weekend. So if you take the rebuild of the offensive line for the Chiefs and combine it with their first 2, 3 picks, boom, that is a great offseason for Kansas City. All right, let's bring on Chip Kelly, UCLA head coach. Big year for him. It's almost like you were before your time in the NFL. Do you look at some of the pollination kind of college football into the NFL now and think, you know, maybe I was about 8 years ahead of it?
You know, if, and I've said this before, but if you weren't in the room with Amos Alonzo Stagg and Newt Rockne when they invented this game, then you stole it from somebody else, you know. So Dutch Myers, who was the head coach of TCU in the 50s, was running empty, no backs, you know, when no one talks about it. You know, everybody talks about when we got to Oregon and we're running up tempo and no huddle. Well, Sam Weish was doing that in the NFL with the Cincinnati Bengals, you know, and Marv Levy was doing it with the Buffalo Bills and the K-Gun, you know. So it's cyclical. I think it's just trying to figure out what applies. The game itself, I think at the next level, has turned into more of a spread out game because people have realized the athletes are so good, we better get them in space. You know, the days of Buddy Ryan was ahead of his game because he ran the 46 defense. Everybody was in two back and you couldn't run the ball, you know, and they had those monsters up front with Singletary behind them, and they played press man on your two receivers and you couldn't get off. So how do you combat those defenses that are all in the box? Is we got to spread people out. And that's where I think the college spread out game has kind of moved to the professional level. And there are some guys, you know, Andy Reid's a great example. You know, you look what Sean Payton's doing with two quarterbacks. And he's got a Hall of Fame quarterback in Drew Brees that he takes out of the game sometimes so Taysom Hill can play. You know, it's I think everybody's still evolving. And that's the fun part. But I think there's a lot of similarities. It used to be really different where college, I think 10, 12 years ago was one way and the NFL was different. But I really think there's a lot of carryover from both now.
When you sped the tempo up collegiately, I remember Nick Saban one time told me privately, he says, I think I can say it now. Yeah. We were up in Bristol and he said, you know, my concern about this, he goes, the officials, the game is so fast. He goes, in the Auburn game, and he didn't want to say this because Auburn beat him, he goes, there were 11 missed calls on both sides. Mm-hmm. He goes, the officials were just not in place. He goes, the athletes will figure out the speed. So will the coaches. I'm not sure 59-year-old officials can. When you were speeding up the tempo, and there were guys like Saban that said, I'm not sure football's meant to be played this fast. Did you mm-hmm. see that as just kind of proprietary? I'm protecting my program. Or were there concerns out there that were legit?
No, I think it was proprietary. You know, the two biggest, and they're two great coaches at the time were Nick Saban and Brett Bielema. But look at what they ran offensively, you know. And I would have been the same way. Like, well, why can't we play fast? Because I think you should play fast. Well, we play fast as an equalizer. So how do we tire out an SC defensive lineman? Because we're not going to be able to line up one-on-one and knock them off the ball. So everybody comes with it with a little bit jaded. And you got to give Nick credit. And that's why he may be the greatest to ever do this game, is he has evolved. And now he does it all. You know, the things he didn't like, he's doing. You know, he was a big guy, didn't like RPOs. They may be the best in the country at RPOs. You know, and so when you look at it, that's what makes him such a great coach, because he's constantly evolving. But I think a lot of that, when you're worried, you know, we all want, if you want to win an argument, how do I get as much fodder on one side than the other? You know, let's play to the referees. We can get the referees on our side and they'll make the game slow down a little bit. But Nick's always looking for an advantage, and he's really done it. You look at what they've done offensively and where they are, you know, you could argue that they're wide receiver you now, which 10 years ago you wouldn't have said that. But now you look at the wideouts that they've turned out in the last couple of years and you're like, holy smokes. They're doing such a good job with it because I think he's evolved with it. But yeah, I can see him saying that, because at that time it was a run the ball guy and let's play great defense. Now it's almost, you got to get a stop or two in each half and then see if you can continue rolling on offense, you know, then you're good to go, you know, and that's really what the game has turned into.
The reason I think Saban's the best college coach I've ever seen is not simply because of winning, mm-hmm. but what hurt Mack Brown, Bobby Bowden, Pete Carroll, and Urban in Florida, that it's transient at the coaching level. Mm-hmm. Pete kept losing coordinator after coordinator. And I remember him telling me once in his office, I'm recruiting coaches as often as I'm recruiting defensive ends.
Yep.
Saban has lost really high in assistants and just keeps reloading.
Yeah.
I find that fascinating. I don't – maybe he's so connected. I mean, just take me to that. the difficulty in losing coaches and having to find good ones that are often better than the previous one.
I don't think he gets enough credit for that, you know, and I think he developed the analyst off the field role that no one really had, and then turned it into a real, almost like a landing spot. You know, when you look at the, just who's been an analyst at Alabama, it's a who's who. You know, it's Sark, it's Mike Loxley, it's Butch Jones, it's Mike Stoops. The list goes on and on. So he almost has a bullpen of guys so that when a guy leaves, he may have the guy already on staff. So the transition for him is the offense and defense and terminology doesn't change. He's not bringing in a new guy that brings in his offense or his defense. He's still running it the way he wants to run it. He did it with Kiff. Lane started off as an analyst, and then he promoted Lane when he lost guys. So he's got a unique system, and I think that unlike anybody else, you know, we only have four analysts, and they're low paying jobs, and they're all real entry level jobs. You know, we don't have what they have, but he set that up because I think he was really conscious of that, is that you're going to lose coaches. So what do I do to combat that? You know, he's got an answer for everything that I think you can look at and say, hey, this is what the next big hurdle is going to be. Well, all right, how do I handle that? And I think you hit it right on, is his ability to replace coaches has been phenomenal, you know, and almost like the next guy comes in is better than the guy that left. And the guy that left was really good.
The single greatest player you've ever coached.
That's a great question. I would say, you know, from a talent standpoint, Jason Peters in Philadelphia was as good a tackle that's ever played the game. Personal favorite was Darren Sproles. You know, you meet Darren Sproles and you're like, wow, like that's an NFL player. And then watch him for 5 minutes in practice, Colin, and you're like, wow, like that's what's so special. We were in a walkthrough, he took a handoff, and it was OTA rules, and you can't do anything. There's so many rules in the offseason, what you can do and can't do. And he sprinted. And I was like, Darren, it's walkthrough. You can't sprint. And he was like, I haven't lasted this long in the NFL by not sprinting, so I'm going to sprint. I said, all right, everybody else walk. Darren's going to run full speed. And everybody you just watched him. I don't know anybody that's ever practiced as hard as he's ever practiced. And when you look at his career, the guy played 13 years in the National Football League. And he's as tough as they come. He's as gracious as they come. He's as competitive as they come. And he could do it all. He could return. He could carry the football. He could catch the ball coming out of the backfield. And he was just an amazing guy to be around on a daily basis. But, you know, those two guys kind of jump out just because of, you know, obviously Jason, just because of how athletic a guy that size. And I mean, he's really a Hall of Fame type tackle, you know, to be around someone. I remember watching him move the first time and I was like, holy smokes, I can't believe how athletic this guy is, you know. And there was a ton of others, you know, coaching Marcus, you know, a good guy won the Heisman Trophy, and Marcus Mariota, and what an amazing athlete and how quick he processed things, you know, the ability to run, how accurate he was, his ability to process things, you know, he was a special player. There was a bunch of really good players that I had an opportunity to coach.
With that, we bring in Chris Ballard. Used to work for the Bears as their director of pro scouting, then hooked up with Andy Reid in Kansas City. He was the director of their football operations and is now the very successful general manager of the Indianapolis Colts. Carson Wentz, to me, has more of an Andrew Luck personality than a Peyton Manning personality, or certainly more than a Phillip Rivers personality. That's what it feels like to me. Little understated, not as verbal, bright kid. What did you know about his personality before you got him in the room?
Well, I mean, look, I've got a guy that coached him for 2 years and was a part of the process of drafting him. So that was a real advantage. And then his college coach was Craig Bohl, who's now at University of Wyoming, who recruited me to University of Wisconsin. So I had an insight there into who he was. And then North Dakota State also, you know, still had some coaches there that we're connected with. But at the end of the day, Frank, and I just have a lot of trust in Frank. I mean, this guy, our head coach, is outstanding, Colin. I mean, he gets it. He played in the league for 14 years. He's brilliant, smart. He's got great emotional intelligence. I mean, I thought that was the one, like Coach Reed always thought had high level emotional intelligence. And I think most great leaders have high level emotional intelligence. And I think Frank does too. And he's just got a great way about him, you know, dealing with the quarterback position. So, you know, his insight. And then when you watch the tape, there's a lot of good tape on Carson Wentz. I mean, I say this all, I mean, I've said this a few times, Colin, but quarterbacks, like you wish all of them came into the league and just lit the league up and never had any struggles. But there's a point when they got to stand on the abyss and not jump. And, you know, that's, we can't let Carson jump. And I don't think Frank will. He didn't play good last year. I think Carson admits that he didn't play good last year. I mean, I don't, and I think Carson would tell you the same thing, that, you know, don't put the blame on everybody else. I mean, we all had our hands in, you know, what happened, you know, back in, you know, last year in Philly, for whatever reason, you know, he was a part of that. But it doesn't mean we still can't see the good and the greatness of what's in him. And we believe it's in there. And we believe, you know, that over time, we'll get him to play at that level again.
For as steady as the Colts have been since you've been here, you have had two of the toughest moments in the league as a GM. You have a coach. He backs out. Thank God you have a great backup plan. And then Andrew Luck retires. And these are like, they don't happen. This isn't stuff you go to college for. You don't, Andy Reid's smart. He can't teach you that. The moment of the Andrew Luck thing, that night, did you sleep? Can I just ask you, did you sleep that night?
So I cared deeply about Andrew, still do, still very close with him. And like a player's health and well-being long-term, it's important to us. It's important to me. I can't operate. We're judged by our wins and losses. That's how we're judged. But on the flip side of that, I cannot be emotionally tied. That's just who I am. Like, I can't change who I am. So I was extremely close with Andrew. So I understood. Did I like it? Absolutely not. I got this beautiful quarterback that is just, he's a top two or three guy in the league. And, you know, we're about to, and we think we got a really good freaking young team and about to freaking take off, and we get thrown a curveball. Well, that's life. I'm explaining it to my children and telling them that, you know what? Nobody cares about the problem. All they care about is if you fix it. That's what our league's about. Now, did I have some moments where, you know, I'll tell you this, Colin, I never had a moment where I felt sorry for myself. And I never had a moment where I let the organization feel sorry for themselves. We were going to just keep moving forward and problem solve and try to fix the problem. And that's all you can do. I mean, it just works out. If you just keep working at this and keep doing things the right way, it's going to work out. I mean, problems happen. You got to fix them. Keep moving forward.
So let's bring in my friend Bill Polian, GM of the Bills, Panthers, Colts, Super Bowl champ in Indy, 6-time NFL Exec of the Year, Pro Football Hall of Fame inductee about 5 years ago, and somebody I've relied on for years, almost strangely as a mentor, even though we don't see each other in person, but I've taken his advice for years. One of the GMs I talked to was not going to draft a player who's talented out of Iowa. And he went to an NFC team and he just said, you know, there's a character risk there and we're not going to go. How many players, because there are some players that are red flag players. If you really loved a guy's talent, how did you weigh, Bill Parcells, if I recall, was a guy that he was going to clean a locker room up. He didn't have a lot of tolerance for, you know, nonsense and character issues. How did you view that? If you really had a player, you loved him, and you thought, you know what, kids make mistakes. I mean, how did you view that stuff?
Well, first and foremost, we were exactly like Bill, because Coach Levy, who taught me about the business, was exactly like that. And so was Tony Dungy. So character was a disqualifier. Bad character was a disqualifier for us. So then you go to the next question, which you correctly pose, is what makes up bad character? Well, everybody makes mistakes. And so let's use the most obvious one, marijuana use. If it's a one or two-time thing, okay. If the guy's been clean a while and there's no issue, and we hear from the school and others that there's no issue, then we're okay. We didn't used to be okay. That's changed as time has gone on. But if a player, and I think I know the player you're talking about. If a player is not a good teammate, if he's disruptive, if he does not work hard, if he's not trustworthy, if he's not a good citizen, if he's a person who is on the wrong side of the law far too often, then he's off the board regardless of talent. And I often tell the story when I speak to scouts or others in the football community. My first year with the Colts, Mr. Irsay had a good friend who was a really knowledgeable guy. He followed the draft. So he came in along with Mr. Irsay to look at the board on Thursday. In those days, the draft began Friday, I think, and or Saturday, maybe. And he looked at the DND list on the sideboard. It said DNDC, which meant do not draft character. And he said, holy mackerel, look, there's a good team up there. What are you guys doing? And Jim said to him, leave them alone. They know what they're doing.
So, right.
And as it turned out, most of the guys that were on that list didn't do well.
Bill, when, I mean, it's obviously Jerry Jones has always had a little greater opinion of his draft knowledge, perhaps, than reality. But he's not the only owner who thinks that, but he's the most notable and most public. In your years, I would guess you would not have tolerated that or you would have moved on. But was there ever a moment, I mean, these billionaires aren't dummies, that an owner did say something to you pre-draft, pre-free agency, kind of a macro opinion that you, I mean, you know, these guys are from 30,000 feet, that an owner said something to you, you know, Bill, I'm not going to get involved with your players, but just, I want you to consider this. Is that a real conversation that ever happened to you and an owner, with between you and an owner?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you the story. It's a great story. Again, the Thursday before the draft, Jim comes in, and Jim Irsay is very knowledgeable. He's been at GM, probably the most knowledgeable owner in terms of pure football. And he did watch film, and he knew what he was looking at. And during the whole process, he would stay hands off. Occasionally, he'd ask me a question about a player or two where, you know, what's the story with the injury? Why is this guy, why did he not play well? But, you know, he was going through the process on his own. And so we get in the draft room and we explain to him that we have a defensive end from Colorado that we like very much. And we have Dallas Clark, and the choice is going to be between those two. And if we get there, you know, tomorrow, Tony and I are going to have to, you know, we still have to talk this out. So Tony says, you know, I really like the defensive end because he can do this and this and this. And I said, you know, I kind of lean toward Dallas Clark because I think he gives our offense a dimension that it doesn't have now. He's a once in kind of a every 10 year type of tight end, not unlike the kid that went to Atlanta. Jim says, well, okay, you know, I trust you guys. I know you'll talk it out and you'll make the right decision. You always do. I trust you completely. So he got up to leave the room and he turned around. And he said, you know, if it were me, I'd take Dallas Clark. And then we all broke up hysterically laughing. And Tony said, well, I guess I know who we're taking now.
All right, I bring in my buddy Matt Mosley, longtime Dallas Cowboys columnist. He's written for the Dallas Morning News, one of the great American newspapers. You know, they're all hanging on by a thread, but that's one of the good ones. ESPN.com, FoxSports.com, The Doomsday Podcast, The Matt Mosley Show, ESPN in Dallas. I may hire him someday for the volume, but we have a limited budget and he's expensive as hell. So he's out there eating chicken fried steak every Saturday night. I can't afford this guy. He's rolling the big dough. Give me the rundown of the division. I'd go Washington first, Philly last. And then I think the Giants and the Cowboys battle for a wild card spot potentially. Your thoughts?
Well, I think you're – I don't know. This guy is a weirdo, it seems like, when I see him talk, the new coach at the Eagles. So I kind of agree with you there. The quarterback thing, I probably – and maybe it's because I've watched so much Big 12, and I think that guy is a huge winner. Like, he's a guy that likes to carry people, and suddenly he has a weapon. Is a big time weapon with him that he knows a little bit. So I would say the Eagles, I have a little higher than you do. I might even sneak the Eagles up into the two spot. I really would. And the Giants, wow. Here's the thing. I don't like the Giants quarterback. They're stuck with this guy seemingly forever. And everybody's like, oh, Danny Dimes or whatever. Yeah, this is a weird. I mean, I think he's third. I think the Giants are third and maybe no, Redskins third and the Giants fourth. Now, who does that leave? Oh, my goodness, the Dallas Cowboys. And what it leaves us with is another rough division, another division. Now, what the Cowboys are hoping, you know, every year it's if nobody gets hurt, we could have greatness. And then, of course, all the offensive linemen get hurt and everything goes to hell. I would just say they got faster. They got some speed, but – I'm telling you, Colin, I've looked at these things before. When you are counting on third round and fourth round players being starters right away, it works for some franchises. It doesn't always work for these guys. And that's what they were trying to do. I mean, they're literally needing, and you know what they're telling you, what Steven and Jerry are telling you is, we don't have the money. We just signed this quarterback. And you do a great job of talking about contract stuff. You understand all that. They just put a huge amount of money in one position. And what they said leading into this draft, almost like an NBA team or something. We got to hit on all of these guys. And this is the future of our defense. So who do they have? Like, who's their big stud on defense? Tank Lawrence. And then name me another one. You got to have it be Parsons. Suddenly you need your number 12 overall pick to be your second best defensive player. Who's the leader? Van Der Esch can't stay healthy. Jalen Smith is just kind of – he's not very good. Who is your leader? Other than you got Tank Lawrence, you got everybody kind of either retiring or heading out. This is a rough – so this is – and you've said it before. This is a team that needs to go out and score 35 and 40 points a game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think Dak this morning is the best quarterback. If Ryan Fitzpatrick, Jalen Hurts, and Danny Dimes are it, the good news is you got a Super Bowl-winning coach – you have the best, arguably best skill people in the division. You've got the best quarterback. I mean, I wouldn't have paid Dak $40 million, but in the end, I think he's the best, most reliable quarterback. Your time of possession goes up. I think Dallas is – Washington defensively, Dallas offensively, you're going to battle to the end for a playoff spot. That's all for this week. Got a great week coming up. Make sure to subscribe and follow us at The Volume Sports on Twitter and Instagram.
The Volume.